This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawera Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, and I am joined today. Actually, I got in trouble for this. So I got ChatGPT to write it.
Did you?
Yeah.
You cheated.
Ladies and gentlemen, buckle up your aprons and sharpen those knives because today's guest is about to bring some serious flavour to the airwaves. He's not just a chef, he's a chef lecturer, inspiring the next generation with sizzling skills and a passion for food that goes way beyond the plate. He's a researcher stirring up new knowledge in the kitchen and in the classroom, blending creativity with evidence to show how food connects to culture, community and well-being. That's good, isn't it?
That's good.
And if that wasn't enough, he's a podcast guest who serves up big ideas with warmth, wit and a sprinkle of storytelling magic. Please join me in giving a roaring radio welcome to the one, the only, Tim Lynch! Woo!
That's outstanding. We should all do that. Everyone should write, ChatGPT, tell something good about me and have that each morning. Just wake up to it. That's fantastic. I was terrified. I had Tony, who I work with, one of my favourite brands in the world, Fugazi. He gave me an AI version of Fugazi. He put the prompt in and said, write a song like Fugazi. And it sounded like Fugazi. I couldn't believe it. I was mortified.
So, Tim, we have been on a 9-week journey of hope. I added it up. I counted them all up.
Wow.
After we've listened to the last bit of this one, we're going to go through and talk about what we've learned from all nine.
Yeah.
And you've got some good summary information.
I'm gonna try my best, but what I have... After 9 weeks, I think I'm more confused than I was when I started. I'm in full circle on it.
Well, only one of the things you want to talk about has got an impossible to pronounce word.
Well, yeah, this is right. This is right.
So, we are playing the second half of what? Of who?
So, we'll go back to the second half of Dr. Aharangi Heke. For me, his summary of hope at the end of this is absolutely astonishing.
Well, over the last couple of years, we've initiated three conferences that are Indigenous knowledge, climate change and wellbeing and humans. And we've invited 20 different Indigenous nations and leading climate change scientists to all three conferences. We've had one or two turn up, but at the last minute, they, for some reason, tend to pull out from coming in. But always plenty of Indigenous representation, not so much from mainstream. And I can see how it would be, you know, perceived as quite a dangerous environment to come into. And it is. It's never going to end well. There's going to be a lot of hard questions. And so they've got to be quite brave to come in there in the first place. In that space, with a number of Indigenous, including Māori, the concept of climate change isn't new. It's been seen before, and you can track some of those back through proxy measures, either through isotopes of oxygen in ice or even through Cody tree or through the growth rate of stalactites. There's a shitload of things you can do around, you know, measuring when those have happened. And there's been a couple of mini ice ages in the past. I've seen paintings from Amsterdam of the canals all frozen solid. So there's information out there about where climate has moved before. Never to this extent, though. Never as large as this. And one of the ways that we've tracked climate in the past, and still do, has been through a process called maramataka, of tracking what we're seeing on a day-to-day basis across one rotation of the moon and at certain times of high tide, low tide, to see what it's causing in animals and in plants. And whether people like it or not, they react like animals to climate change. And so we're seeing things in humans at the same time. So the first thing about it is, for a number of Indigenous people, climate isn't seen as something completely new and out of hand. It's been around a few times and gone a few times. We're not suggesting that it's going to leave anytime soon or that we're the experts on it. But the partnership with Google represents an opportunity for accessing data gathering mechanisms to look at what contributions anybody that's from the Pacific could provide, of which Māori are one, but with the knowledge that the Pacific, if you were to be in space, it's the single biggest artifact on the planet. From space, you can't see past either side of the Pacific. It covers a 180-degree view, and it travels from, you know, above Japan and all the way down to the Antarctic Circle. So it's huge. Why I'm telling you that is that the climate for the whole planet comes from the Pacific. And yet, there's been no discussion or questions with those people that have lived in the ocean of the Pacific for the longest about what they've seen, what they've noted in changes. So to me, it's the dumbest shit to not ask people that have lived there for thousands and thousands of years, what have you noticed? But to take the word of contemporary scientists who have got an objective view to begin with that wants to cut all of that out and see what they say. If it was the combination, that wouldn't make sense.
If we think about the notion of identity, though, if we think about the notion of identity being associated with climate, and you're on the Kiribati Islands, and you know they're taking places, you know, they're taking many countries to court at the moment because of their contribution to climate change. I guess a bit that I'm interested about is the erosion of identity that could occur from climate change, and how that could look on an indigenous space, whether it be Māori, Kiribati, Pacific Island, Pacifica.
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that climate change is a reality when your island and your home are underwater. And if you're from Kiribati, that's a given. And so anybody that's kind of questioning that in the first instance has got the head up their ass. Secondly, much like Google, we've got a whole range of data that we've chosen to never share because we didn't just trust the people who have been extractive in the past. But at the moment, we represent an alternative voice that could contribute to saving the whole planet, whether we're Māori, Kiribati or Pāka. So Māori have kind of arrived, as have a number of other Polynesian groups, at a point where we're going to have to commit. We're going to have to provide some answers. And in there, whether that's seen as, you know, a recolonization or whether it's seen as dangerous for the Indigenous people themselves to do it, the reason that we're attempting to take a systems approach to this is that it does just that. It removes ethnicity, it removes gender, it removes age, it removes colour, it removes a whole range of things and allows us to have a discussion about the transition of knowledge through a format that could save a planet. And so if we get stuck on colonisation, the planet will die in the meantime. And so was it worth it? And we've arrived at that point where we're having to have a good hard look at ourselves about who is it we're actually trying to stop and who is it that is going to suffer from this if we don't engage. And to be blunt, of course I know about colonization. You know, I live it. And I know about some of the concepts that are in that space. So it's not something we're not aware of and concerned about and have a fearful of, but the alternative's worse, to not be in the room.
It's interesting, that idea of the alternative of inaction worse action. And I feel for myself in like the work that I'm doing at the moment, is that's the thing that comes up more and more. Is like, look, well, you know, if we do nothing, we're screwed. If we do something, it may be wrong, but we can change it. And it's that dilemma that we're sort of facing at the moment. I mean, for yourself, because you work across you work across multiple cultures, you work across multiple areas. Are there areas where you have seen the embedding of like cultural knowledge and environmental concern that have been really well considered or have been active and they've worked particularly well?
I have. I've seen a number of those. But just for a moment to pop back to the idea of being of inaction, actually, that is inaction, to be inactive, as you know. To not engage is also a position that you have to choose to take. And in terms of climate, it's not a bad one. because it will administer to itself if we get out of the road. And we saw that during COVID, that when we weren't extracting resources from the environment, it flourished. And therefore, so did the engagement by people with it, because they could see that it was providing a means of health and well-being without the extraction added to it. So I can see the benefits in there of doing that. And I've often said, actually, sometimes we just got to get humans out of the road and let environment do what it's going to do. Ironically, nobody would expect me to engage with this type of thinking. I don't look like someone that would come into this space. I don't act like someone that would be in this space either, because I'm usually outdoors, engaged with a whole range of things that would be seen to probably be contributing to it. You know, I ski a lot. I'm on mountain bikes a lot. I'm out in those places. But what I often choose to say to people is they're a medium for the connection to a mountain. And from the mountain, I get a whole range of feedback on some of the thinking that I've had. And if you want a solution to climate change, it's not with people. It's from the environment that's involved in it. And to have a discussion about the warming of the sea without your feet in the sea to allow the biggest player in the discussion to contribute is unethical. Because if I have a discussion with students and their feet are in the water, it dramatically changes the way they discuss what's going on versus in a classroom, because now everybody's included. But for humans to say, well, that's ridiculous, we don't need the sea involved in it. But I said, well, what's a discussion about the sea? And as Indigenous, we're related to the sea. And it has a form of language. It just isn't verbalised through the moving of vocal cords. The way it does it is through a tide crashing or an interval between the length of wave peaks. And ultimately, it comes down to being an issue of recruitment, of how do you recruit thinking from people to be able to be sustained without it being seen as confrontation, although confrontation is useful sometimes, but how do you first get them through the door? Because it doesn't really matter how convincing your arguments are if they won't come through the door, because knowledge exists, but you still have to read it. You still have to be involved with it, and you still have to engage and roll it around in your mouth a bit before you get a taste for it. So recruitment is a big issue. And for some, you need multiple mediums to cause that. And then very quickly, and this is particularly from a systems perspective, you then have to drop down into the sustainability level of how do you get them to come back. And the coming back is where you shift from that macro level of this is what stars, water and land do to this is what happens in your 50K radius. And this is an explanation for the way you move. Or this is an explanation for the fact that subconsciously you act like a river but don't know you're doing it. And here's some of the personality traits you have that are expressing that. All of a sudden they're yours. They're there for life, because now there's a reason for them to want to be there. And as kind of shallow as that is to begin with about making it about the person, you still have to get them engaged in the door. And then as they learn more, they start to change. And before they know it, they become an agent for change without knowing that they're doing it. And in my opinion, that environmental change by stealth is probably the most useful platform, because they then become the strongest advocate on behalf of environment when they believe it was their idea.
I mean, for yourself, you know, like you work with the Rangitaki, athletes, elders, communities, all the way around Aotearoa. What gives you the most hope when you look at how you know, Māori are reinventing or like reimagining or becoming part of their relationships with the environment?
Part of it is that they have a blood memory of these places but have just been dislocated from it since probably mid-60s. There was a Hun report, which you might be aware of, 66, I think that came out, that insisted on assimilation of all Māori into mainstream thinking. And there was a pepper potting housing initiative to stick one Māori family surrounded by six or seven Pākehā people in Auckland in order to get them to stop being Māori, because these ideas of being environment-centred were causing trouble for everybody. So we were cut off from it. There was a Tohunga Suppression Act, 1907, I think, that meant that we couldn't practice these ways of thinking. So they've been gone for a long time. We're bringing these back. People were seeing them. And in there, they're gathering and garnering hope for the first time in a long time. Because now the way they think is being not only defended, but encouraged. And the things that they used to find frustrating are now being heralded as ways that others are trying to think like. And I can give them examples from groups within Google, you know, individuals within Google. I have to point out too that, you know, the idea of being environmentally centered for a place like Google is total hypocrisy, because they're not interested in that. They're only interested in fiscal gain. So I see that, but it's still a useful mechanism for causing change as well, because the brand power of Google means that I get access to great thinkers. I tell them I'm working for Google. I get to talk to all sorts of AI engineers and philosophers and experts in their field on, you know, what they think's going on. So that's been crazy useful, and that's Google that have got that access.
What does that, sorry to interrupt, what does that feel like?
It must be 6 months ago, actually probably more like 12 months ago. I presented at Berkeley in California with one of the top-tier Google execs. And the guy that asked us to present was a 2IC with one of the big telecorp bloody organizations. The guy that was number one is the one that had a team in America's Cup. So fairly high end, you know. And I had to go there and have a discussion about what it meant to be a modernist. And a lot of people were like, why is there an Indigenous guy here? But it provided a counter to what Google were doing, but that the platform that Google represents is useful to us to investigate things that we do want to know. And at the time when I stood up, I said, you know, Google are the devil. And she got quite pissy about it. And says, can you not refer to me as the devil? I said, well, one of the things you need to know about Māori is that we call our enemies our hōariri, which means they're our angry friends. So you need to keep the devil right next to you so you know what's going on. And that's what we're doing. So I said, none of it's coincidental or an accident. It's purposeful. So in there, I think, is where that idea of hope can flourish, because we're getting access to some great thinkers. We're leveraging off platforms that are unusual, and we're present. We're not waiting for shit to happen. We're making it happen.
It's been an absolute pleasure, mate. Thank you. I've taken far more of your time than I thought I was going to, but it's just been a pleasure talking to you. It absolutely has. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being part of this journey for me and contributing to it. And hopefully the people that listen to this will take some of your words and roll with them and take something from it. I think if you think of your your immediate family, what makes you hopeful for them?
I've often said to them, we have to have hope, otherwise where do we go to from here? And aspirational thinkers that we surround ourselves with us supply that. And when, you know, it gets on top of you thinking, shit, climate change is going to be difficult to overcome, without hope, you would agree with it and you'd let it go. So on a day-to-day basis, I obtain solutions and aspirational thinking from the environment itself. When I go out into the mountains, I come back refreshed and renewed and ready to have another go. Institute in Washington, D.C., as professor in accounting at Harvard. And he said to me, what are you hopeful about? And I said, well, the reason I go to the environment is there's three channels that I use. And it keeps turning up in a whole range of places. I said, firstly, when you have someone who's Māori introduce them to you, they will tell you not only what their mountain and river is, but they'll say things three times. So you would have heard this, no doubt. Well, they'll say, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. When they're doing that, they're introducing themselves to your physical presence, to your intellect, and to your spirit. And so therefore, when it comes to hope and the pursuit of knowledge, you will have heard of mātauranga, which is in essence the idea that knowledge exists. But it's the second and third tier that not many people know of, because in the second space around mōhiotanga, that's the drive to build capacity. And that means that you have to enter those environments, engage with them, and develop new ways of knowing. And in there, you're seeing globally the interest by Indigenous nations in developing their own capacity to lead and to create hope through having their own doctors or their own accountants and their own lawyers. But what's particular to Māori and came up for this professor from Harvard was, and he asked if he could use the model actually, which was pretty funny, is the third domain. The third domain isn't practiced by many Indigenous nations at all. And for some reason, we still do. And whenever I travel globally, other Indigenous nations will say to us, you're 30 years ahead, which we find crazy because it feels like we're doing a shit job. But the third domain is dynamic capability. And in there, it's your ability to take information from the past and reconstitute it into contemporary applications so that you provide and create hope for generations that are surrounding you now. And that's where we tend to live. That's where we tend to spend the majority of our time as Māori at the moment, is looking what is our contribution to dynamic capability by taking an environmental concept from an ancestor and reapplying it into a domain that it's never been put before and was never intended to be used for before, and creating new ways of knowing based on environmental concepts from the past. That's it. That's hope.
You said jump, I said hi. Exactly, you want me to jump too. Mm-hmm. And you say walk, I will walk to the end of the line and back to you. Mm-hmm. My name is Steve and I'm your walking man. Yes, I am. Say, boy, do you really love me? Well, I ain't got much words to say. Hey, hey. Let me write my answer down in the sand by the waves. Hey, hey. My name is Steve and I'm your riding man. Yes, I am. My name's Steve and I'm your walking man. Yes, I am. If you want me to stay, I'll stash my sleeping roll under your bed. That says more than anything in my life I ever said. My name is Steve and I'm your staying man. Yes, I am. My name is Steve and I'm your riding man. Yes, I am. My name is Steve and I'm your walking man. Yes, I am.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm with Tim Lynch, and that was...
That was Walking Man by C6 Steve.
So, Tim, do we want to go through all nine people, and you can, in right. your hopeful collection? I've got them written down, and you can tell us what each one of them said, just to summarise, and then you've got some inspirational thoughts to pull it all together.
Well, I have... at some stage, Sam, you're going to have to read my doctorate, and I am doing a thematic analysis of them. So there will be those connections between the theory and of hope and the practice and how they relate to these podcasts. But I don't think I want to torture any of the listeners with a thematic analysis just yet of what it...
Okay, so let's just go through and you just tell us... Let's recap.
Okay.
Bubble wrapped hope, Minamata.
So Minamata was, for me, it was an idea of hope as something which is forward thinking. Hope is a method for change, and hope is a way to reimagine something positive from something that was tragic and horrendous. Thousands of people died. The destruction of a huge ecosystem, the alienation and removal of people's connections to those environments, the tensions that occurred within families societally that came from, and hope showed the use of it as a navigation tool to go from something as tragic and as disruptive as that into something which has now become a positive tool that they use.
And then because the Minamata one kind of led on naturally from the show you did about anger, we then stopped and did a bit of a focus on that pivot from anger to hope.
Yeah, and that shift, and the reason for that is they're intertwined. You can't have one emotion without the other. There is an intertwined. It's like it's a braided rope. And what hope does is hope allows the rope from being brittle and snapping to something more like a bungee cord, which is able to move and contract depending on what is required.
Hopefully blowing in the wind. Giacomo.
Yeah, technological hope. I mean, we all think that there's like a sort of technological solution to everything. I remember you actually asked me if climate change had a techno-focused solution to it, which at the time I wasn't quite sure how to respond to. But if you think of what Giacomo is talking about, you know, for him, hope does lie in the notion of technological advancements. In a lot of ways, it's, you know, I don't want to get too bogged down with theories, but it is sort of Malthusian in that respect, in the regards that, you know, there are, to some degree, some of the solutions, not all of the solutions, may lie in a re-evaluating of some of the technology that we use and how we go about using them as well.
Bubbles with the Botanicals. Richard Wilson, Sandy Mount Distillery.
Yeah, that was just good fun. it was great. Any interview you walk away with a bottle of gin from is a fantastic interview. But I mean, within that, the idea for, you know, climate change and hope there, as it shows, you know, hope manifesting itself in a way that in a business that is able to be self-sustaining and is moving for something which has purpose and has meaning, something which is of meaning to him and the community, and that's what it's all around. I still remember sitting there when the distillery manager walked in and she was followed by all the chickens, and he was just like, this is what it's all about. That there, right there, you can see there is the distillery manager, the chickens, this is my home, this product is of the environment, and that connection to environment, to sort of reinforce what Ohorangi was saying, there's something with really deep and significant within that, which about climate change is our connection and our relationship with the environment and how we engage with it. I think some of the most significant things we do about climate change with our students here on Polytech is within the Living Campus, because it allows them to connect to something which isn't concrete or not manipulated or denuded. It's something which is organic and real.
I should be getting you to match the titles that I came up with the people. Up through the ground came a bubbling food. Deb Manning.
Deb Manning, that was awesome. Man, what a powerhouse of an individual. If you look at what she has achieved, her Wikipedia page is just astonishing, you know. So for her, the notion of hope is in helping other people. So for her, hope is in providing for other people, is in engaging with societally level hope. It's a hope which is kind of critical and about social change. And that's really powerful stuff. You know, when you're talking with people like Deborah Manning who use hope as a motivator to keep them on task, to keep them going, it's quite remarkable. I mean, if you think about social change and critical hope, it's an awareness that being passive is not good enough. To just hope passively is not enough. You have to be active with your hope.
And then you went left field. Actually, you went right field.
I went right field. I thought it was going to be left.
Swollen bubbles.
It was supposed to go left field.
Bryce McKenzie,
what an interesting guy. Man, that conversation, I map out all my questions before I go in there, because I try to put like a bit of a narrative arc into the conversation. So we start here, we get into the middle of it, and then by the time we get to the end of the conversation, we're trying to summarize things. It just went completely left field. This is an assumption on my part. When I looked up about Bryce, and you look on things like The Platform, and you know he's being interviewed by people like Michael Laws, the assumption is that he is very much on the right wing side of things. And the purpose initially was to actually use Bryce as a counterpoint to all this sort of left thinking stuff. In the same way with the first series that I did on anger, I had to, you know, get a counterpoint to that. But as it turns out, we were on the same page about a lot of things. Like, and not just me, he was on the same page with the Green Party with a lot of his conversations. And that really shocked me. So his idea of hope was ecological as well. I mean, there's a lot of commonalities between listening to Bryce McKenzie and listening to Ihurangi Hiki. They talk about ecology and the relationship with the ecology in a very, very similar way, and the relations with it. Even the kind of genealogical components of it, they both talk about in a very similar way.
Hopefully tasting natural bubbles.
Hopefully tasting natural bubbles. Was that the title?
That's what I called it, Clinton Chambers.
I can't remember signing off on that title. Clinton was fantastic because, once again, what Clinton represents is hope within a structural system and change within a structural system. So for him, he's operating within wider sort of structural systems such as the council. And I think for my doctorate, a lot of it is surrounding those systems and how to integrate within them. And in fact, a lot of the work that I'm doing with my doctorate, I think, will intersect with what Clinton is doing, particularly surrounding people growing food in their backyard. So once again, that connection to ecology, environment, coming to the fore. If you also listen to what he was talking about, he talks a lot about holistic hope. And that's that eudaimonic notion of hope. Yeah, it came out. I got it in there. And, okay, for those that aren't familiar with this, if we think of hedonic hope, which is something which is just going to immediately pleasure me, like going a bottle of booze or whatever. And one of the tensions we have here at Polytech with students is that they're all about this hedonic hope. They want the quick fix thing to make them feel good. But we're about the eudaimonic hope, which is this deeper sense of purpose and well-being. And so there's always a tension when lecturers are talking about what well-being is and what students think well-being should be for them. For them, well-being is a bottle in the backyard with their mates. For us, we think of well-being as being something far more spiritually connected.
And lastly, which we just heard the second half of, Whakapapa of Hopeful Bubbles.
Yeah, I'm going to be mulling this one over for a long time. Like, I have revisited that conversation a couple of times since then, and when you consider a lot of the things that Ehring is sort of talking about, the one that really struck me is he starts talking about dynamic capability. And initially, I wasn't sure what he meant by this notion of dynamic capability. But when he unpacked it, this ability to take, you know, to take knowledge, embedded knowledge, whether it's genealogical, from the past and then put it into the future, environmental concepts that from the past that are then placed into the future, and he talks about how that is hopeful, that I found kind of astonishing. Because he then also talked about how a lot of indigenous knowledge was being used in AI development and how that also gave him hope. And I found that quite head-twisting that this, you know, it's taken us to this stage of human evolution for us to finally look back at the indigenous knowledge systems and find some way to digitally use it. I found quite amazing. There's a whole lot of reasons for that, obviously, but the listening to that being spoken to, I found quite powerful, to be honest.
Let's put on some music, and then we'll have Tahu, and then we'll talk about what we can take from that in the bigger picture and what sorts of hope there are. Who have we got next?
Let's go for Bonus by a band called Knotlist.
Sprite of the wild coasts, secluded inlets, and forest and beaches of Otago Peninsula, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu McKenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi arohanui, kia koutou, ko tahu hou. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars, and your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are, whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day. Who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now I know that for us all, the last several years have been Very interesting. So many new ways of doing, being, seeing, feeling have been required for us to navigate all the changes that have happened externally and internally, and all the ways in which we have been asked to draw upon new skills and work together, play together, be a part in so many unexpected ways. And now we find ourselves navigating in a new world, having had these shared experiences. And how grateful I am that as a species, we are so creative, we are innately adaptable, and we have the desire and the proclivity and the skills to come together and share and learn and grow. And of course, this beautiful show is a testament to that. And I'm so grateful to Sam and the whole Glowing Bubbles team for having me. Thank you. It's a great pleasure and privilege to be with you in this way. And of course, for myself, I am embarking on a new adventure, having had a dream about helping the Hoiho. I find myself back my Turukawawa here on the Otago Peninsula. And you know, each day I'm just learning so much more. And it's a wonderful thing to be in a new environment and receptive to all of the gifts of that environment. I'm very fortunate to have got my inheritance early, building my dream house out here, right by the sea, my dream. And of course, at this time, in being in a new environment, there's so much that my whole being is just flooded with gratitude for. And so, of course, gratitude has come to the forefront of my mind at this time. And as we know, and being a human being, our physical body can illuminate the many ways in which we can beneficially move in this world for ourselves and other life forms. And gratitude plays a big part in this. More and more, we are encouraged to find ways to build gratitude into our day, consciously and subconsciously, unconsciously on all levels. And by focusing on those things that we are grateful for, physiologically, emotionally, all those ways that our perception of the world influences our perception of ourselves, and the chemicals that rush through our bloodstream, gratitude can help us so much to make the most of our time here. And this could be in the form of a list. This could be in the form of many creative approaches, artwork, music, all these ways in which we choose to express as a species. And for me, that state of receptivity and openness to new perceptions, new perspectives, is another way in which gravity can move in my life. So I really hope for you that you're finding those ways in your day, in your experience, to bring gratitude in and look around you with eyes that have seen so much, of course, and can see so much more, always. Lovely to be with you again, and I look forward to talking to you soon. Thanks so much. Kakite.
Welcome back, Tahu. You are listening to Glowing Bubbles. I'm talking with the very fabulous, and we'll go through the whole thing again, Tim Lynch. So, Tim, what are we taking from this?
Well, hope's essential. It's essential across psychological and physiological, social, environmental domains. Individually, it broadens thinking, it strengthens resilience, it helps pursue meaningful goals. Collectively, the energy behind social movements, community empowerment, environmental action, generally is rooted in the notion of hope, far more so than anger, more often. You know, if you think about hope being, you know, the most, you know, authentic of the emotions, you know, it's not about naive wishful thinking. It's a force for transformation that allows navigation from within the present. But if you also think about the hope that Ihorangi talks about, you know, hope allows us to draw from the past and then use our learnings from the past to navigate into the future. I mean, that allows for, you know, ideally like a better version of ourselves. Hope is courage, you know. Hope is imagination. Hope is responsibility. hope is what allows designers to imagine what could be in a future state. And all of those components are really significant and pertinent to how all the different cogs mesh together for climate change. Because if we think of the relationship between climate change and hope, if we didn't have hope, we would simply have despair. And despair as an emotion is tiring, it's exhausting, whereas hope is energizing and uplifting. And that's it's weaving of the resilience and motivation and meaning that where hope lies. Hope's not one-dimensional. If I look at the difference between when I was talking about hope and anger, hope's sophisticated and nuanced and delicate. Anger was blunt and direct. And at the time, I thought anger was the more powerful of the two, but it's hope which has the power. You know, if you think about, you know, Barack Obama, when he got elected, the speech that got him, I would say, and many argue, the presidency was when he talks about the audacity of hope. And if you think of that notion of hope being audacious, it really is. Hope's daring. It's risk-taking. It's all of those things.
We talked early on about it not being hope without action. I think you described that as toxic hope.
Yes.
And then you just talked about hope being quite nuanced. You talked about eudaimonic hope, that sort of deeper sense of purpose. That's not necessarily tied to action. So that risks perhaps being toxic?
I think eudaimonic hope is in looking for that higher sense of purpose. The action is internal as compared to externalized. And hope is multifaceted in that respect. If we compare it to anger once again, if for myself, I used to be a younger man.
Did you?
Once I was, yes. But my ability to internalize something like anger was very different. Whereas the internalizing of hope is something you carry with you is very different. And I don't think it's passive, and I don't think it's toxic. I think it's actually something which is inherently hopeful. And I think this is where hope even starts to shift into the metaphysical in some ways, particularly around the eudaimonic stuff, and that it does allow for the ideal that my life can have a higher purpose and be of something of more significance than what is right here and now in front of me.
Your connection to all of this is looking to shape culinary education. It's not possible to talk about education without talking about Ferrer.
No, it's not.
Who has a take on hope?
Yep, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, the classic. We all know it well. I mean, Ferrer's take on hope pedagogically or about education is really interesting, because he looked at the hope that can come from education, particularly in areas where there's been impoverished peoples or where there has been oppression. And he talks about how hope is used as a method or a way to, in conjunction with education, to uplift students in that respect.
So his critical hope means that you have to be doing something. And Jonathan Lear takes that a bit further to radical hope.
Yeah. And this is, I think, we kind of almost cross over into when we go back a step into the likes of when we're talking about anger, and that crossover between radical hope of things that you do. But if he talked about whakapapa being an action word, and that's when hope also becomes an action word. And I think that's probably the important thing within that, is that that notion between active and passive. And for me, that's where that lies.
But also he's talking about hope when we don't necessarily know what the answer is.
Totally. And that's the thing that hope does. Hope allows you to move towards something when you don't know what the outcome is fixed. And that's one of the significant things about hope. So there's not, and if you think about that as a really, that's a really quite powerful thing to visualize, is that as a human being, it allows us to move towards something that can be better, even though we don't know what that is. If you think about that intergenerationally, you know, we see that in New Zealand between the generations that have migrated here. They have hope for a better life for their children, even though they may not see it. It's a whole notion of, you know, planting trees to shade under for other people.
To what extent are we hoping for
a bright new world, and does that get in the way of us doing stuff?
I don't think it gets in the way of us doing stuff. I think the notion of the bright, shiny new world that we're all hoping for will come through our active engagement with it. I don't think it'll come from a passive observation of it. That's solely my belief.
But you know that cartoon about somebody complaining about society and someone else saying, ah, but you live in society. I am very clever. And it's that, you know, the thing about the climate protest kids, you know, had their cell phones, you know, and their parents drove them there in their cars.
Yeah. It's like, it's a funny thing that I remember I was sitting in a meeting and I was talking about one of the interviews I'd done in Zurich, and because it was about sustainability, and a couple of people laughed. I was thinking, how can you be talking about sustainability with someone in Zurich when you're from New Zealand? Well, you know, we're not going to get a situation where international travel stops, where global commerce comes to an end. None of that's going to happen. The conversation is about how we manage it in a way that has benefit to all, and that's really what it's about. So, you know, if we look at the difference between, say, cornucopian theory and Malthusian theory, one states that we need population growth and we can think our way out of this. Another says that we have to actually kind of control our resources and manage them better. You know, one is saying effectively electric cars are going to get us out of this problem. The other is saying, well, actually, we need to limit the amount of cars that people have. There is this theory that sustainability and climate change, the entire globe is going to become vegan, and somehow we're going to levitate from one place to another. And this thing called commerce, which we have created, is going to stop. I mean, I heard a great quote about commerce that said, you know, it's one of the most powerful things we've created, but unfortunately, you know, it's like we've discovered a Ferrari and we've got it stuck in reverse. And it is a little bit like that. The tools and mechanisms are there. It's the way that we are engaging with them, I think, is the bit which we need to readdress. You know, I enjoy holidays overseas. I enjoy different cultures. Everyone does. That's the great, beautiful thing about human beings, is the ability to cross-pollinate ideas and cultures. That's not going to stop. So there's this kind of really boring binary argument that people take against things like society, which is, oh, but you drove your car here. Well, of course I did. You know, well, actually, I take my push bike to work most times. But yes, I do have a car. My hot water is heated by gas. The question is where we get the gas from and how we're getting that gas is what we need to be looking at. You know, the question is not about having, you know, we need to have, you know, having hot, warm homes or not. It's about how the homes are insulated, how efficiently we're using the energy to keep them warm. And so that's what we need to start looking at. And it becomes like a really boring argument, that notion of, well, you're just a hypocrite because you own a car, you can't talk about sustainability. And so, well, no, that's not strictly true.
Okay, I've got three more questions.
Yep.
And we're going to have to rattle.
Okay.
What are you telling your students so far?
Well, actually, at the moment, we are going through a paper on carbon reduction for large-scale food outlets. So at the moment, we're actually wading through how the notion of climate change and your position on climate change relates to personal identity and how we need to understand that in order to be able to present food which has a lower carbon footprint in a way that isn't seen as being punitive. Do you say a short answer?
You've talked through lots of different sorts of hope, and your notes in front of you have got lots of different sorts of hope more.
Yep.
Have you come up with a new hope? That could be a good movie title. Have you got a new hope, or is it a combination of these ones?
I have a new hope. What I found interesting about hope as a subject is it reinforces a lot of my own beliefs, and particularly that notion of connection with environment and ecology and the relationship and how that not only is a positive, but it also is good for the environment. I think one of the biggest thing we can do about climate change is increase our relationship with the environment.
And lastly, this point I normally say any advice for our listeners, but that's not what I'm going to say. If you've got any advice for you?
Get more sleep.
Okay, the question I was going to ask then is, you're going to come back and talk about action?
Yeah, I'm going to come back and talk about action. So the next series is going to be about the things that I'm doing. The things, so that notion of what, of hope being an action, things that I'm doing, what am I engaging with, how am I taking all these learnings and putting them in a meaningful way, which is going to affect some, just turn the dial ever so slightly on some of my concerns surrounding climate change.
What song are we going out to?
Let's go for a song called Unfiltered by a band called Interpol.
Done. You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces, around the world, brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago University. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. I'm Samuel Mann, he's Tim Lynch. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mati wā.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.